Okay, so today we will talk about political violence. We will have many sessions about political violence. Today is definition of war, different types of political violence, and then also how this can be avoided from a realist perspective. So we will talk about deterrence, when deterrence works and when deterrence fails. Okay, first I would like to take up on where I finished yesterday. So some tips on how to write your essays. You know that next week I will present a question that you will have to answer within 1 week. The essays have to be uploaded on the ILIAS web page of your tutorial. This is the first thing. And the second thing is that you have to bring a hard copy to this class, and here every hard copy that is delivered after 10 a.m., so after this class, will lead to 5. And also the texts have to be uploaded until 5. So please upload the tutorials, upload your texts on the ILIAS webpage of the tutorial you are in. If you're not yet here a formal member, an ILIAS member of a tutorial, then please do so within the next few days. Okay, now more interestingly, how to write an essay. An essay is, this type of essay is simply something which you experienced in high school when you had to answer a question from your German teacher, but you have to be a little bit more aggressive. So I do not expect from you to come up with thesis, antithesis, synthesis. You just come with a thesis, an answer to the question, which is basically a hypothesis, and you justify your hypothesis. This is what I expect from you. And this should be somehow theoretically inspired by what you have learned in class. Here, you do not have necessarily to quote scholars for your points, but if you do so, then quote in the necessary detail. I mean, scholars have names, and you might have a quote from a page, so you also have to live up to the standards for citing other people. Then, an essay starts out with a title, and the title should always contain the thesis. The same is true for an academic study. So don't write texts in the Teutonic manner, where you have just a collection of nouns with no clear order. I was once listening to a philosopher in a prize ceremony. This guy was supposed to speak for half an hour. The title had about 5 nouns. And after 40 minutes, because 2 other nouns were not yet covered, it was clear for me that he would speak for another 20 minutes. So a clear message in the title, and then you start out the text by briefly presenting your thesis. And this is the abstract, which could consist of 2 to 3 sentences. And then you have the main body of the text, and you have 800 words all in all to make your point. Don't make 5 points, simply make 1 or 2 points because there is not enough space. Okay, then about the style, please write in complete sentences. Do not write in do not come up with 2 long sentences. English differs somehow here from German academic language. English is easier, but it also means that your sentences have to be clear. Okay, and then you should avoid what I write here down in the second last point, avoid trite statements. Just something like the world is a complex and dangerous place. This is absolutely boring. So come up with your own thoughts and be specific by answering the question. Okay, I have here down here a mock question. You can think about this, and you will go through this question and how to answer this question in the tutorials. Is long-lasting and deep cooperation between China and the U.S. possible? Inspired, obviously, by the recent visit by the POTUS in the People's Republic of China. Okay, there are some texts which allow you to figure out how to write academic texts. One of them is by Steven Pinker, whom you know from yesterday. This is this linguist from Harvard University. He's this silver-haired, good-looking U.S. Professor who has much more expensive boots than I have, so I'm very envious. A colleague wanted to invite him for a presentation next spring, but he's apparently finishing his next book, so he's then signed up for a book tour next spring. So this is the book here on which this short article is based that he has written after the book that we discussed very briefly yesterday, and also have tried on some occasion to be funny, and you can download this text from the webpage of the university in, if you are interested in my jokes and haven't had enough from listening to this lecture. Anyway, are there questions with regard to the essay? Okay. Actually, I have written this text together with my co-author, Uncle G, and one of the reviewers of this article asked then, who is Uncle G? And then I responded in my memo to the editor, there is fortunately, there is not yet grandfather G. Okay, so now let's move to the study of political violence. Here again, a gallery of people who have contributed over the last few decades to our understanding of political violence. So I have here people then like Louis Fry Richardson, who was one of the first who came up with a collection of or a list of wars. The same was true for Quincy Wright, who came up with such a list in the 1930s and 1940s, who was a professor at the University of Chicago. Anatole Rapoport, you already know from the tit-for-tat strategy, an important social psychologist. Karl Wolfgang Deutsch, I also mentioned beforehand. This is Johan Galtung. This is the founder of the Peace Research Institute at Oslo and the Journal of Peace Research. Dina Sinnes, from the University of Iowa, who has made important contributions. No, she's not. She's from the University of Illinois. Sorry about that. Dina Sinnes has made important contributions in the footsteps of Richardson for the study of arms races. You have my mentor, David Singer, who passed away about seven years ago. Bruce Russett, long-term editor of the Journal of Conflict Resolution, also a mentor of mine. And then you have my friend and co-author, Niels Peter Gleditsch, whose son, Christian Gleditsch, is a visiting professor at the University of Konstanz for 2 years more. Okay, so there are different manifestations of political violence. Today we will mainly talk about war. We will talk about other manifestations of political violence later on. So first, what is a war? I already asked this question once, but want to have it in your brains, in your DNA, for the remainder of this class. So how do you define a war? Organized actors with some sort of political motivation. So these are not mafiosi clans who can also engage in something which is similar to a war, but they have to have some sort of political motive, and they have an issue over which they disagree, and one of the actors wants to change the status quo, at least. And then what about the violence? It has to be reciprocal use of violence, and both sides have to suffer fatalities. So soldiers have to be dying. In the Correlates of War project, which is the project that was initiated by David Singer in the 60s, they started out with a threshold of 1,000 battle deaths per year. And future definitions have lowered this threshold, going down to 25 battle deaths per year. This is, for instance, then the definition that is accepted in a second data collection, which is collected by the Peace Research Institute Oslo and Uppsala University. So this is now the, let's say, the European data or the Scandinavian data collection. Okay, so we have then different forms of wars, and I will get back to this in a minute. What is constitutive of for one-sided violence, genocide, massacres? How would you define that? A specific group of people, but this group has to be unarmed. So these are mainly civilians, but they can also be soldiers, but they do not have to, cannot carry weapons. So this is an asymmetrical use of force, and this is very similar, obviously, then to repression, torture, or more general human rights violations. And we will also get back to that. What is terrorism? So probably the form of political violence one is most afraid of at the moment, with the exception perhaps of possible nuclear war or the usage of nuclear weapons in the Far East. Okay. So in most cases, terrorist acts come from the David in an exchange with Goliath. They cannot, do not have the means to engage into regular battles. So they use attacks against civilians, against politicians, as a way to create terror. And when you think about ISIS, and I already asked this question once, but just to make this clear, what is the goal of ISIS? Okay, like any other political group, they somehow want to change the status quo, and they pursue then economic and political goals. Quite often they want to conquer a certain territory, build a state. The ambition is to create an Islamic state. Okay, some people in the 1960s, 1970s, they came up, this was Johann Galtung, they came up with the notion of structural violence. This doesn't play any longer a big role, but this is the notion that certain structures are unjust and that they create violence. What is the problem with such an all-encompassing definition of violence? I mean, you cannot use it basically for empirical research. I have similar reservation towards the usage of the notion of ethnic wars. What is perhaps somehow misleading in the notion of ethnic wars? So most civil wars are somehow fought across or along ethnic cleavages. But that doesn't presuppose that these are really ethnic wars where ethnicity explains the occurrence of violence. So ethnic civil war somehow is a tautology, and it's not a very useful category. Some people disagree, so Niels Weimann might have a slightly different opinion here, but I do not find this a particularly helpful notion. Okay, so let's look first, before we move towards the understanding of conflict, let's first move a little bit towards the statistics here, and for the signed readings, you had this article from the Uppsala Research Group, Alanson, Melander, and Temner. The people at Uppsala University, they publish each year in the Journal of Peace Research a statistic where they just update the lists of ongoing political violence. When you look at the fatalities and how they have evolved over the years. What happened here in 1994, which led to this dramatic increase in the number of fatalities. And this was largely then one-sided violence, meaning civilian victimization. That's the genocide in Rwanda. And you also then see that here the kind of violence and where the violence takes place changes over time. So here a lot of the violence is for state-based armed conflict, mainly in this period civil wars. And then you also have here included non-state conflict where basically two groups within civil war, for instance, fight each other, but the state is not necessarily a party of this conflict. Okay, when you look at the number of ongoing wars and here the minimal definition of 25 fatalities per year is used, then you see an increase in the number of wars until the 1990s, then a decrease, which has contributed to this optimism by Pinker and other people that war is waning and led to the controversy. And then you have seen an increase here. What has contributed to this increase? Which wars? Sudan, South Sudan, mainly at the moment. For which conflict do we have the forecast that humanitarian catastrophe is looming? So Yemen is another kind of conflict. So the greatest bulk of conflict nowadays are civil wars, not interstate wars. There is a category included here, and this is one of the categories that is due to the Correlates of War project of David Singer. This is the category of extra-state wars. What's an extra-state war? It's not a proxy war, although in this period, because it was the Cold War, you have seen proxy wars where there were, for instance, civil wars and one group was affiliated with the Soviet Union and the state, the government was then affiliated rather towards the United States. That's a typical proxy war, so a minor conflict fought somehow on behalf of the superpowers of this period. An extra-state war is a state a war of a member of the Westphalian system of states, recognized states, against another entity which is not a state. And these are largely colonial wars because these colonial powers, they were not recognized as states. So they were outside of the system of states. And you see that this kind of category is just disappears in the 1970s. What were some of the last colonial wars that were fought? Does anyone recall them? The last colonial empires, or the last colonial empire that somehow disappeared. So Portugal had a colonial empire, and there were civil wars in Angola and Mozambique, or extra-state wars that were transformed then later on into civil wars. Why do we have seen this increase here? What happened here, which led to a large number of civil wars at the end of the Cold War? But an increase which started earlier. So somehow this shows that the post-colonial states were quite often fragile. The order there did not hold. And simultaneously you saw the breakdown of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of Yugoslavia. And this was linked to different civil wars, including Bosnia and the civil wars in Russia and its the post-Soviet republics. Okay, so this is about war. I have some other slides here. So what you also see here when you distinguish between the minimal threshold and the large-scale wars, so down here you have the large-scale wars which live up to the definition of Dave Singer. So you see here a decrease, but then also this increase, which is due to what we experience in the Middle East post Arab Spring. Okay, when you look at the fatalities and how they are distributed over the globe, then you also experience that conflict has largely disappeared from Europe, not completely, but the largest bulk of conflicts is in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. So why? But also the number of conflicts or countries at conflict in Africa has somehow vanished. So you see here the early 2000s, many conflicts in Africa. What was the bloodiest conflict fought in Africa in this period? The conflict in Congo, and you see here then also the number of fatalities. When you look at survey evidence, then some people believe that many more people have died in this particular conflict, but that's always the most conservative estimate that the people at Uppsala report here. So these are the bloodiest conflicts, and you see that there is no conflict in Europe is included in this list, which leads then to our illusion that the world has become a friendlier place in this regard. Okay, I have here a definition of conflict by Karl von Clausewitz. Who was Karl von Clausewitz? So this was a Prussian military officer who developed a theory of war on which quite some people draw. And what he has here is an instrumental definition of war, that war should just be understood as a political instrument. This is not a very useful definition, but it has inspired many theories that are still used today for the understanding of political violence. And the quote here is, "War, therefore, is an act of violence to compel our opponent to fill our will. We see, therefore, that war is not merely an act of policy, but a true political instrument." And this is what he is famous for, a continuation of political intercourse carried on with other means. So you just have it as a substitute for other political acts, and actors are goal-driven. But we largely rely in this class here on operational definitions like the one here by Bruce Rossett or the Correlates of War project. Okay. Here's just the typology of the Correlates of War project, what plays a bigger role here because data collection has become more important. You also have communal wars where sub-state actors fight each other, and there are some new databases with regard to that, and all the other notions I have already introduced by now. Okay. Data sources, I mentioned the Correlates of War project, then for one side of political violence you have mainly the collections at Uppsala University, state repression, you have the political terror scale, and I will rely on these resources to illustrate to you the extent of state repression. There are databases that help us to understand terrorism, the ITERATE database by Todd Sandler and colleagues, and then for the Global Terrorism Database. And what we have now since some years are so-called event data sets. And here's the Penn State event data set collected by Phil Schroth and colleagues. He was beforehand at Kansas, so it's still called, and sometimes the CATS data set, and as I mentioned beforehand, the Uppsala data collection. So how does such a data set look like? First here, just an illustration, but I will get back to our understanding of terrorism later on. in this class, and you also have this article by Todd Sandler in your reading list. So this is an event data set, which is quite controversial, but you see here that given the density of information and just the computational means that we have nowadays, people then collect data about on a very fine-grained scale. So this is just from the Arab Spring, where particular political events happened in Cairo. So this obviously helps us to understand the micro dynamics of conflict. Sometimes it's just a lot of data, but we do then miss theoretical explanations that could help us to understand the dynamics here. Okay, so what is important now for the reminder when we look at war and its occurrence theoretically, that not all crises end in conflict. So many conflicts have an escalation beforehand, and what you see then during this escalation period, that one side gives in. So one state starts out the conflict with putting forward a demand. Then the other side might react by then threatening to use force or the display of force. And then you see that not all of those end up then in war. So you see many more instances of lower scale conflict where you fortunately do not have then blood spread that one or both sides lose military forces. And for our understanding here, what is quite good data set is the militarized interstate dispute data set. There is also an international crisis data set, but which has not been updated that far. That's also part of the Correlates of War project by David Singer and colleagues. So when you think about display of force, how does this typically take place? So you have a crisis. Kim sends some missile over the Pacific, and then our friend Donald is not satisfied with this action. So what might be steps that follow such an act, such a provocation? There are then sanctions, but sanctions is a milder form here that doesn't yet involve necessarily a threat to use force or a display of force. So movement of military troops, mobilization of troops, you send them to the border, or since these superpowers are also always naval powers, you send some ships to this particular area. And for the United States, a particularly funny mishap happened this spring when Kim started the latest round of provocations in the confrontation with South Korea and the United States. What happened? So the ship ended up in the wrong place, so which was not a particularly useful threat and not very credible. So realists would attribute this success that not all conflicts end up in the usage of large-scale violence as attribute this to the success of deterrence. And this is now the next issue that I want to cover. So what is deterrence? You mentioned sanctions beforehand. Sanctions and deterrence work in a very similar way. So you have one actor, which is actor A here, and this actor A makes potentially a demand. It can also renounce to make such a demand, and actor B reacts to this by threatening to use force. And if no such demand is made, then deterrence is successful. You can think about deterrence underlying all security policy making. Although you do not have a crisis, you also have a threat. So there are military capabilities around the world and no demands are made. This is general deterrence, but you can distinguish this then from immediate deterrence. This is when you have a situation of crisis where actually a first sort of demand is made or a provocation or whatever you call it, and then the other side reacts, and by issuing then a threat to use force, the other side is supposed to give in. So what you create is that you create costs for the other side, which leads the other side then to give in such a situation. Okay, you can also distinguish direct forms of deterrence, where you have a bilateral interaction between an attacker and a defender. And you can have extended deterrence, where you have then a protege state, which is in an alliance with a larger state, and the deterrent threat comes from this larger state. So can anyone give me an example of extended deterrence? US and Taiwan, most states there are somehow in the region are allies of the United States. With Taiwan, it's not completely clear, since Taiwan is a pariah state. So you recall Nixon went to China. This led to the breakup of the relations of the United States with Taiwan, but there's still some security guarantees towards Taiwan in case that China would invade Taiwan, which is considered, the Chinese consider to be part of their territory. Okay, so other forms of extended deterrence, other cases, they are then also part of NATO, which is automatically then a form of extended deterrence. So an alliance also always involves the promise that you would protect the member states and their security. This is just a list of an article out by Paul Hughes, the current editor of the Journal of Conflict Resolution, and Bruce Rossett. And you see here in their analysis of extended deterrence that in some cases you have successes and then you also have failures. And failure means that the deterrence threat was not successful. You had an escalation and this led then to a military kind of confrontation. So the study of deterrence basically means that you try to understand the conditions under which deterrence then works. So the distinction between deterrence and compellence. Deterrence is a more passive form of political act, and compellence forces an attacker or a potential attacker to change its course of action. Whereas with deterrence, you just try to prevent that this actor, this potential attacker, acts in the first place. Okay. So then what is also important here, that since the Cold War started, people thought about how we can understand this, and the first model that was used for the study of deterrence is the chicken game. And once again, I know that this is quite nauseatic for you, but what are the predictions for the chicken game? Yeah, and there are two equilibrium pure strategies. So one side then always gives in, But since you have mixed strategy, basically everything can happen depending then on the payoff. So also both heading over the cliff could be an action here. The chicken game has played a role in movie history, a movie which featured James Dean. Yep. Extortion is something I know only from mafia movies, if we remain in the cinema for a moment. I mean, you would say you have another mafia clan, you have someone extorting a particular group, and then you would have an actor trying to tell them through the threat to use force, you have to give up this particular strategy, otherwise we will start a war or whatever. Hmm? So this would be then a reaction to that. This would be equal to compellence. I mean, this distinction between compellence and deterrence is due to Thomas Schelling, whom I mentioned before, and who will play a big role later on. Who has seen this movie, Rebel Without a Cause, which is not a particularly good movie, but with a good-looking guy, James Dean, who died prematurely. How this movie ends, so James Dean is basically the hero, but according to the game theory, he's the one who is not heading over the cliff. But the other guy heads then over the cliff, and this is due to the fact that his clothes gets mingled with the wheel of his car, so he cannot then avoid to drive over the cliff. So this is basically a conflict due to accident. And the fear of nuclear accidents was particularly wide in the 1970s and 1980s, where you would have then a situation of confrontation played out later on. Okay, so the chicken game is not useful because you have a dynamic situation, but inspired other models, and other models were slightly more dynamic. So what you have here is basically models of an arms race. Both sides invest in military capabilities, and they react to each other's acquisition of arms. So what you have here is what is called then also reaction curves. So you have here the military capabilities by actor A, and here the military capabilities by actor B. And the more A invests, the more B will invest. And when you have an intersection of these two reaction curves, then you have here an equilibrium at point T. All the curves, all the points on these curves are Nash equilibria, but then the stable equilibria where both sides do not have an incentive to move away is situated here. So this would then be the prediction. Both sides arm sufficiently, and they deter each other from the usage of force. But when you do not have such a situation, so you do not have an intersection of these curves, then you have an arms race that might lead to conflict. But people have still moved away from this sort of analysis that you can buy peace simply by arming yourself sufficiently. And this is due then to discoveries made by people like Thomas Schelling, and I will come back to this in a minute, because he introduced the notion of credibility. A threat to use force has to be credible, and not all threats are credible. So there's no linear relationship between your investment in military capabilities and the success that you will have in a crisis. Okay, so the classic view, which is the view which you just saw there in the picture here, is that you can buy peace by investing in military capabilities or forming alliances. So this is the realist perspective, this is balance of power, the bipolarity notion here. And these are quantitative arms races. So you acquire stock, but you also have qualitative arms races where you change the logic of interaction. Can anyone give me a current example where the logic of deterrence changes because a new type of technology is developed? So drones is something completely new, but doesn't necessarily change, let's say, the confrontation between the United States and Russia that we have. Yeah. Cyber conflict might lead to this. In what regard? If North Korea is able to do what with the U.S. military? So hack the rocket shield so that they can no longer use the nuclear weapons in response to a potential attack of North Korea on South Korea. Realists who advocate the usage and the acquisition of nuclear weapons, who believe that nuclear weapons are important if both sides in a conflict have nuclear weapons, they are against qualitative arms races, which change the logic of this balance of terror, to which I will come back in a minute. You can also think about what actually the United States tries to provide in Eastern Europe, but also in East Asia, by creating nuclear shields. Technology, you send a rocket against an incoming rocket from the other side, and obviously you have the hope that this shield functions perfectly, because otherwise, obviously, it would still have then the balance of terror. Or Israel has such shields against incoming missiles from the Gaza Strip or from Iran, and beforehand from Iraq. So these are missile defense systems. This increases in this logic then the risk of conflict. And we have already discussed the notion for classic realists, Mersheimer and so on, that proliferation is a good thing, and discussed the underlying madness that is behind this particular policy recommendation. Okay, there are criticisms of this perspective, that this doesn't work out in a fine way. So what has happened here is that people started to look at deterrence situation but through the usage of non-cooperative game theory, moved away from these matrix games, which are cooperative game theory, and looked at the dynamics. And here you see one typical case here of a potential escalation process. Important contributions have been made by these two authors, Frank Zagari and Mark Kilger. So you have a potential challenger, an attacker. You have here a defender. There is a demand. The defender can react to this by a counter demand. And then might be a possible escalation. Might go back to the defender, and then you might have one side winning or an all-out conflict. So you have the escalation towards a large-scale conflict in such situation. And this is called crisis bargaining. And deterrence success is when obviously no demand is made in the first place. But it's also a partial success, at least, if one side here already gives in at an early stage. So a military confrontation is then avoided. Okay. Here, again, you see that deterrence seems to be successful. We have fewer military crises. We have fewer interstate wars in recent years. And this is obviously controversial whether we still face the risk of large-scale wars like we had the World War I and World War II, and these wars obviously would be catastrophic events. Okay, when you look at crises and how these escalate, they start out with particular demands, and quite often these demands are for a territory. Why does one side want to have territory? So what's are the different values that actors can attribute to a territory? So there are resources, this is then strategic, or economic advantages that are linked to that. So there might be oil fields. So think about Hitler and Nazi Germany, who wanted to go to the oil fields in the Middle East, but also in Romania and so on, and the Soviet Union. So this is important, obviously, for the continuation of the conflict. And then military value. The textbook describes this as symbolic value. So that might have been the motherland of a particular ethnic group, although politicians are quite inventive in figuring out certain events and attributing this to a particular territory, also post hoc, when generations cannot recall that. So, but here is another hot zone in the world, and you see that three large countries are involved in this confrontation, Pakistan, India and China, and occasionally there are military confrontations, quite recently fighting troops engaged in small-scale battles on some glacier at the border of Pakistan, India and China. These are the models here. So for a conventional threat to analyze that, the simplest model is simply by the attacker making a demand. The defender can resist this, so potentially use force, or it can accept the demand. And the status quo gives both sides a payoff of zero. So this is no demand is made. And here you have a conventional threat, and you can then simply threaten to use force, and this is worse than a worse outcome for the one making a demand, but it's a better outcome than for the defender than to accept the demand. So you see here these particular payoffs. So noticing that this demand would be rejected, then the attacker has to defend to compare this pass against the status quo, and then deterrence works. So no demand is made. So because the defender, the attacker would face here and then military costs, which are larger than what it has here under the status quo, so it will be losing. But this doesn't work under a situation where one side has nuclear weapons. Why doesn't a threat to use force not work in this particular situation? Okay. Both sides lose in this particular situation. So what you would need here to make this situation work is more fine-grained escalation ladder, and to come up with this particular situation. And the guy who was here very innovative was Thomas Schelling with his strategy of brinkmanship, which I will explain in a moment. But the general models have been developed by Jim Fearon, and they are described at length in the textbook. So I will give you now just an analysis of what you have, or summarize what you have in the textbook. So to understand these interactions between an attacker and a defender, you need to know certain notions. So one of them is resolve, and this is the willingness of an actor to endure costs. And you have to show resolve that you are committed to the status quo, that you do not accept the demand to the other side in order to make deterrence work in such a particular situation. A second thing that I already mentioned, threats have to be credible, so capabilities are not sufficient, and then you have to credibly commit yourself to a particular position. So you say, this is my situation, this is my position, and I will not move away from this position. How can you make such a commitment to a particular negotiation position? How can you make this credible or increase the credibility of such a commitment? But you tell the people back home that we will not accept such a demand. So that's why statements then by political leaders in a crisis situations are very important. And what is typically created is then a red line. So you say, I'm standing here, this is the red line. If the other side crosses this red line, then we will escalate the conflict further. But you do not necessarily say, then we will send our nuclear weapons to this other side. Okay, brinkmanship, and I will come back to this later, is the strategy developed by Tom Schelling. In the textbook, you also have mentioned other strategies. Tying hands, this is what you have just described here, by creating audience costs. So you address the own public, but this, you send out a message to the other side and you commit yourself to this particular topic, and then you have to pay for something, so you have to increase your costs, and this is linked then to resolve, and this you do, for instance, through mobilization or sending battleships in the region of conflict. So these are the typical steps that are undertaken here. Similar kind of political instruments are actually used by central banks. So the insights of Thomas Schelling were not only influencing military strategy, but also influencing then monetary policy making. So if you think about what Mario Draghi, the chief of the European Central Bank, has done when he said that we will save the euro at whatever cost, this is exactly based on the same logic. It's a commitment strategy and trying to send a credible signal to potential speculators out there. Okay, so when you analyze this situation, and this is just a Fearon model that I mentioned last week, you have a situation where both sides have try to come up with a political situation in a conflict. So what you have here is basically the bargaining zone, and there is a possible deal is located. So this is not yet completely interesting. So, but what you also have to think about is that people can change the status quo, change the situation through the usage of force. So they can try to conquer a territory. So think about this bargaining zone as a territory. One side makes a demand, but it can also then change the status quo by simply conquering the territory. Here A is more powerful, so it can expect to have a larger share than actor B. But fighting a war is obviously costly, so you have to think about then how large these costs are. So you have the potential outcome here. This would be the war outcome, and these are the costs to side A, and these are the costs to side B. And so this is the remaining bargaining zone that you have then in a potential conflict. So in the Fearon model, you always expect that there is potential for bargaining in such a situation. You see here then that when you look at such a situation, actor A is on this side and looks over to this side. Actor B is on the other side, looks over to this side. You have the ranges here and the bargaining range or the zone of agreement. And all these are the deals one prefers over the war. And this is the deal that the potential deals B prefers over the war. And you have the intersection of these two zones, very similar to the analysis I presented yesterday, so where they could potentially find an agreement. And now Fearon makes the argument that obviously when you have a bargaining zone and in a situation of complete information, and when you have sequential bargaining, so for instance, actor A makes the first move, then in such a particular situation, actor A just makes a demand to actor B that makes this actor B indifferent between an agreement and the usage of force. So it gets a deal without resorting to conflict. But in a situation where you have incomplete information, so people do not know how large the costs of war are, for instance, then actors have an incentive to misrepresent their strengths, and this creates then a possibility of conflict. So incomplete information of at least one actor is a source of conflict. This is the first insight by Fearon that I already mentioned last week, and he also includes then different outcomes. What is important here, this is the second ingredient, is then also the status quo and the location of the status quo makes it then somehow attractive to use force. And it depends on whether the status quo is in the within the bargaining range or within the green zones over here or over here, whether you have a likelihood of conflict. But it's important to understand that you need incomplete information for a war to occur in such a situation. This is then the situation that Fearon has here included. So as I said beforehand, in this region where the status quo is in here, you might have a chance of conflict because you're dissatisfied with the status quo, and the same is happening over here. But if you are here within the bargaining zone, then no challenge to the status quo will be made. But when you are over here, you also need incomplete information or then incredible commitment strategies in order to experience conflict. For the second explanation of conflict in the Fearon model, you have these commitment problems. And these commitment problems, you can mainly distinguish two types. So you can have a situation of shifting power. So in the long range, you have one actor which grows more quickly than the other actor. This will change the status quo in the long term. And this might make a war in the short term by the declining power an attractive notion. So what you would then fight is a potential preventive war because you cannot avoid to be challenged by the other side in the long term. Can anyone give an example where you have had a conflict between declining power and then rising power? So this would be potential ancient explanation, but sometimes the outbreak of World War I with Germany as a rising power is also described as such a conflict, although obviously there were other reasons for this particular conflict. So this is simply the realist perspective. And which country is the rising power at the moment? Where some people make scenarios that there might be then this sort of preventive war taking place. Yeah. So China against the United States. And you have obviously some indication that China, at least in its region, is not satisfied with the status quo. So you have these territorial disputes in the Pacific Ocean between China and the Philippines, China, South Korea, China and Japan, and so on. And so this is one second explanation. And another explanation is then if one state has a first strike advantage over the other side. This explanation does not fundamentally differ from the shifting power explanation. It's simply a question of the time perspective, but you are somehow have an advantage over the other side. And what you see here is that to some extent here the bargaining sets are then not overlapping in this particular side. What is important here that the value of war for the both sides is then quite disproportionate. So when you look here at this situation and compare it to this situation over here. Can anyone give me an example of where you had, let's say, a surprise war where one side attacked the other side overnight, basically, to prevent to be attacked by the other side? So the Six-Day War in 1967, I mean, the troops of the Allies against Israel were mobilizing, there was an alert, and then Israel was able to outsmart the other side, and this was then followed up by the Yom Kippur War 6 years later, which ended in a stalemate, which still influences the situation in the Middle East to a considerable extent. So there are examples here. What is important here, most conflicts start with an escalation. So you have a crisis, but when you have this particular situation, then you have a surprising event taking place, like, for instance, the attack of Israel on its neighbor in 1967. Let's move to the nuclear situation and what Tom Schelling developed, the important notion of brinkmanship. Tom Schelling was a very good writer. So here you have one of numerous illustrations of how you can make deterrence work. So you have a situation of two non-swimmers. They sit in a rowing boat, and one of them is not contributing to the joint effort, just sits there, and you're obviously dissatisfied with this situation. And what you do then in such a situation, that in order to force the other side to also contribute to the rowing effort, that you create a risk that you can no longer create completely. And you do so by starting to shake the boat. So this is then what he describes here. You create the risk of a little bit of death. So it's not a complete escalation immediately, but it's important that you cannot completely control this. So this is also the notion here. Brinkmanship is equivalent to a threat that leaves something to chance. So you create a small risk that this conflict might get out of hand, and then the other side should give in. What are the underlying assumptions that are behind this logic, which might make this work? So you assume that the other side is risk-averse, but you might have people who like that there is a certain risk. They like to sit in a boat that is shaking and that they might drown at a certain moment. So this would then be risk-taking people. So if this situation only, or this strategy only works if you are dealing then with risk-averse people, not with risk-acceptant people. So only with this is credible, and you saw then developments in the strategy of the nuclear powers that are equivalent to what Schelling recommended in this particular situation. What is the strategy of NATO since the 1960s? So the strategy since the 1960s is also adopted in the time that the threat to use force by the other side became credible, is the strategy of flexible response. And this means that you do not immediately launch a nuclear war if you notice a demand by the other side with which you disagree. Beforehand, it was just that you should have reacted to any kind of demand by the Soviet side by starting to attack the other side. So if a Soviet colonel would have crossed with some soldiers the border in from East Berlin to West Berlin, this would have been a demand which should have triggered then a nuclear attack by the United States until 1967, when this strategy of flexible response became the official policy. Donald Trump reacted somewhere this summer, I don't recall the exact date, when there was a provocation by the North Korean leader by saying he was sitting at a table, and would have been a very short clip, that Kim, North Korea, has to expect fire and fury if there is a further provocation, or what he conceives to be a provocation. What does this, is this a good strategy to threaten here fire and the devastation of the other country in such a confrontation? Yeah, so this is just too much. So he goes about five steps forward, and he should have had a response that is much clearer. So such a response, what should he have said instead of just coming with the threat of the nuclear devastation, of basically destroying North Korea, which has, I think, about 28 million inhabitants. So this is not a small country. So, but he just threatens to extinguish an entire country. And he should have left this open. I mean, a response would have been to assure South Korea that we are supporting you in case of a potential attack. Also Japan, what he did, he was then simultaneously creating a trade dispute with South Korea, which is completely stupid because he undermines the military alliance. And a measured tone is very important, where you leave open the options that will follow, and you do not immediately threaten military force. So this is just very dangerous. You can say, okay, he says a lot of things, and he also, you might recall from last weekend on his way home, do you recall how he described Kim? Short and fat, and what kind of response to another North Korean language was that? Yeah. So, I mean, lunatic and kind of person who is basically crazy, and you cannot count on him. So mental illness is a problem, and obviously North Korea was helped by the quite open discussion on whether you should have someone like Trump behind the nuclear wheel in this confrontation with the other side. But I mean, very, let's say, intellectual, low-key exchange of words, but the dangerous thing is that these words are not very measured, at least not from the Western side. So this can contribute, obviously, and increase the danger of a nuclear confrontation unnecessarily. I mean, the crisis is there. There is always a risk of a nuclear confrontation, but this risk has been increased very suddenly through the not very careful drafting of words. And one has to fear that he simply does not understand what the danger is and what the risks are in these situations. Okay, there have been situations of nuclear brinkmanship. I have could have included here the most recent cases. I mean, these are nuclear crises where one side, I mean, this is largely the Cold War, where one side threatened to use nuclear weapons to the other side. How do you do this, for instance? By testing. This has been done by Russia recently during the confrontation over the Crimea and the eastern Ukraine. Yeah. And you sometimes simply, it's sufficient to open the door for the bunkers where you have your nuclear weapons, because you know that the other side knows exactly where the rockets are located. So the satellites are flying over, and this is then full information. They know that they are preparing for a potential nuclear confrontation. So this happened, for instance, during the non-Yom Kippur War. Someone mentioned very early in this class the notion of the proxy war, to some extent the war of Israel against its neighbor was also a proxy war. So here you had Israel supported by the United States, you had Egypt supported by the Soviet Union, so this was a proxy war, and both sides sent a non-verbal warning to the other side by simply preparing for a potential nuclear confrontation in this particular situation. Tom Schelling, when he received the Nobel Prize, he gave a very favorable assessment of his own theory, so he said then, the most spectacular event of the past half century is one that did not occur. We have enjoyed 60 years without nuclear weapons exploded in anger. We may come to a new respect for deterrence. So this was obviously clapping his own shoulder. So I have made these important discoveries. This has made the world safer place. Now, the question is whether another Nobel Prize winner, namely Kotze, who is a Nobel Prize South African writer, fiction writer, now residing in Australia. If you ever read a book by him or two books by him, you're sure to get a depression. So very good novels, but very depressing novels. And in one of his novels, he writes also about the danger of a nuclear war. So the question is now, when you have terrorist organization like ISIS who try to acquire nuclear devices, dirty bombs and so on, or also Al-Qaeda, one knows that they think about these weapons. But the question is whether Kotze is right or whether terrorists would use nuclear weapons. So, do you believe that this is a danger? What would happen if the Islamic State lets a dirty weapon explode in Lower Manhattan, around the Trump Tower, and then Manhattan would no longer be a place where you could live in for the next 100 years, and obviously thousands of people would die at such an event. Is this a large-scale danger, or what happens when you have the planners of these terrorist organizations? Okay, it depends on your assessment of these groups. I mean, if you have a really suicidal group, then you might not be able to prevent something like that. But most political organizations, they somehow want to survive and obviously enjoy the benefits of their particular acts. So I do not believe that this assessment by this writer is a particular good one, but I mean there are dangers involved, and it's quite easy to have such weapons constructed. Does anyone know where Kim has the engineers for his nuclear weapons program? They do not necessarily come from Russia. The supporters are disgruntled engineers from eastern Ukraine. And there is also at least tacit support, and some people might come from Iran and Pakistan. And North Korea itself helps other countries develop the rocket technology. So it's also an arms dealer who is involved here. Okay. Still, the notion of realists that nuclear weapons help in military confrontation, there is some empirical support for this. So there is an early study here by Jim Fearon in support of that, although the standard error is quite large. So you see here then what he has just looked at different crises and attributes of the states and the coefficient here, but the standard error is quite large. There is a more recent study looking at similar evidence by Birdsley and Azal. So they look at the nuclear powers, at militarized interstates disputes, and you see then that in such a situation you have then nuclear weapons who have a deterrent effect on the other side. So the logic or the hypothesis of realism is not completely invalid. That's one of the lessons one can draw from that. And a final consideration, I will skip. This is obviously non-rational attributes of a crisis. And this is nicely depicted in the Stanley Kubrick movie, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And you see here the final scene with a US colonel with a cowboy hat straddling a nuclear weapon. And the end final scene is our nuclear bombs exploding all over the globe. So this is the general reproach here. So you have also one scientist who helps in the development of nuclear weapons. This is scientist is played by Peter Sellers. As I said last week, some people believed that the guy he played here was John von Neumann, so one of the founders of game theory. So there are also obviously non-rational factors which contribute here, and I will talk about these non-rational factors next week. See you then.